is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and Henry Frain is at the controls. Before we get on to this hour's program, which is from the Focus Archives, I want to mention tomorrow. In the first hour, the 10 o'clock hour, the guest will be Douglas Brinkley. He's an historian and is also director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies and professor of history at University of New Orleans. And we'll be talking about a recent book that he's authored that explores some of the early life of John Kerry, senator and Democratic presidential candidate, concentrating primarily on his experiences in Vietnam and following that up through to the 1970s and some of his involvement in politics, and looking at the overall question of how it is his political experiences, both successes and failures, were all shaped by his experience in Vietnam. So that's tomorrow. The title of the book is Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War. That's in the first hour of the show. In hour number two, we'll be talking about politics in Israel, and our guest there will be Meron Medzini. He's an academic. He's a senior lecturer at both Tel Aviv University and also Hebrew University. He's going to be visiting here the campus. His particular area of study, his academic interests, are all in East Asia. But we'll be talking about contemporary Middle Eastern politics with him, and particularly the continuing conflict between the government of Israel and the Palestinians. That'll be tomorrow in the second part of the show. So as always, in both cases, questions and comments are welcome. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, so we always welcome questions and comments. We also have a comprehensive web archive of past programs, not just Focus 580, but also interviews that have aired on the Afternoon Magazine and other shows. In fact, all of our local production is on the website. So if you have missed something the first time, or you'd like to hear a program again that you heard first time around, it's all there on the website. We also have the software available there for you to put into your computer so that you can listen. And it's all there at will.uiuc.edu. Well, this part of the show, we're going to the archives for a program from last year, a conversation with planetary scientist David Grinspoon. Bear in mind that as you listen, this program is an archive. We'll be not taking your calls this morning. This show was first broadcast on December 31st of last year. In the first hour of the show today, we'll spend some time speculating on the possibility of life elsewhere in the cosmos. How widespread might it be, life and intelligence? How do we think about that? How can we, working with the definition of life as we know it here on this planet, think about the forms that life might take on other planets? Some of the questions that we will discuss this morning in the first hour of the show with planetary scientist David Grinspoon. He is principal scientist in the Department of Space Studies at the Southwest Research Institute. He's also adjunct professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at University of Colorado. In addition, he is an advisor to NASA. He has done research funded by NASA. He studies the evolution of habitable worlds. He's also been an advisor to NASA on space exploration policy. He has written a couple of books. A previous book, Venus Revealed, was a Los Angeles Times Book Prize finalist. He has also written for Astronomy, Nature, Science, Scientific American, Natural History, and the Sciences. His newest book, which has just been out now for a little while, is titled Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. And it is now out in bookstores It's published by HarperCollins, division of HarperCollins, if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, questions on this program are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. David Grinspoon, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we certainly appreciate it. It seems to me that you know, when it comes to thinking about the possibility of extraterrestrial life, there have been for some time now two camps. There is the Aliens Among Us camp, which contains those people who truly do believe in UFOs, who believe that not only is there extraterrestrial life, but there has been contact between them and human beings here on this earth. And then there's the scientific camp, and those are the people who would say something like, I can't tell you where it is, I can't tell you what form it would take, but I believe that somewhere in the vast cosmos there is life, that Earth is not the only place. And it seems that for a long time these two groups of people didn't have a lot to do with each other. At least the scientists didn't want to be associated with the UFO people. What do these two groups of people have in common?
Well, that's a great question. As I researched and wrote Lonely Planets, you know, for several years I was completely immersed in this topic of aliens, and I had many conversations with many different kinds of people, including some of the true believers who approached it from a not very scientific standpoint. I went to a lot of UFO meetings and conspiracy meetings and so forth and talked to some believers and abductions. And then, of course, I spent as well a lot of time in sort of the other camp, because I am a scientist and I go to a lot of scientific meetings, and I've been to a lot of astrobiology meetings where scientists talk about extraterrestrial life. And as you say, these are two entirely different approaches, yet I was struck by the fact that basically everybody believes in aliens. That, you know, that there's this core belief that emerges whoever you talk to. It's very rare to find somebody that doesn't believe in extraterrestrial life, no matter what their philosophical orientation is. And I actually concluded that, in a certain way, somewhere deep down inside, the reasons for this belief are more similar than we might think across this wide gulf of belief. Hmm. And one thing that's interesting is that even for the scientists who, you know, pride themselves generally on their rationality, and I kind of include myself in that group, pretty much, there's still kind of a leap of faith that you have to make to get to this belief in alien life. You know, there's all this science that points us in that direction. Findings about our Earth, findings about the wider universe that encourage us to believe in aliens, and yet we still don't have any evidence. So there's still a leap of faith. And to me, that's fascinating, a scientific belief that requires faith. And in some ways, it creates, I think, a little bit of a bridge between what seems these opposite philosophies.
Hmm. It seems that one of the things that you see, if you look at this idea that there is life elsewhere, is that it's not a new idea. And if you go back, you find that there were ancient peoples who believed that we were not alone in the universe. And it seems that the basic idea, one of the basic ideas that this rests on, is simply the observation that the universe, as we know it, and of course, over time, what we know about it has changed, but the idea is the universe as we know it is so vast that the idea is that in all of this vastness, it doesn't make sense to think that this place right here would be the only place where there would be life. Is that the basic idea?
That's right. That's the core belief that I think unites these disparate kinds of believers in extraterrestrial life. The idea that in such a vast universe, what are the chances that we are alone is still the core argument that scientists make. You know, even though we've learned so much more about other planets and learned so much more about the evolution of life here and all these tidbits of information that encourage us to believe that what happened here is in some sense not extraordinary, that, mm-hmm. that the evolution of life as we understand it, the origin of life, ought to occur elsewhere. But it still comes down to, in such a wide universe, how could it not have happened elsewhere. And you hear the same logic again at UFO conventions. You know, I've gone to some meetings where some of these UFO believers who would seem in their overall beliefs to be quite sort of wacky to a mainstream scientist, they'll start their talk by saying, in such a wide universe, you know, with 10 to the 22nd stars out there, how could we be the only planet with life, which is the exact same thing the scientists say. And if you look historically, this is an argument that goes way back. The Greek atomists, thousands of years ago, had this idea. They thought that the universe was infinite, made of an infinite number of worlds, and therefore all things that were possible somewhere must be realized somewhere in that infinite universe, and therefore there must be life. So it's a very, very old idea. And another thing that's interesting historically is that once we realized that there were other planets, which really happened 400 years ago with what we call the Copernican Revolution, when, you know, Galileo basically proved that the Earth was not the center of everything, and suddenly people realized that there were many other worlds out there. It was basically proven. The idea of extraterrestrial life in the 1600s was rampant. In fact, it was at least as widespread as today, among European intellectuals. It was commonly believed that all the other planets in the solar system were not only inhabited, but were probably inhabited with intelligent life and maybe even human beings. So in some sense, in modern times, we sort of retreated a little bit from that optimism of believing that our neighboring planets all had intelligent life. So even though we tend to think of this idea of intelligent life on other planets as a very modern idea that modern science has sort of prepared us to accept and prepared us for some fantastic discovery that's about to come, if you look historically, it's actually an old idea, and if anything, the 20th century was a time of greater pessimism than any other time in the last 400 years about extraterrestrial life.
Hmm. Well, while certainly a lot of people have made that kind of argument, and it seems like quite a reasonable argument that says the universe is so big, we should assume that out of all of the many stars, there have got to be other stars that have planets around them, and some of those planets have to be hospitable to life. At the same time, reasonable people have made counterarguments, and I'd leap ahead to Enrico Fermi, and he, a famous physicist, the story is told that one day he and some colleagues were sort of sitting around, and they were talking about this very thing, raised that question, the cosmos is such a big place, how could it be that this is the only place where there is life? And his question was, well, okay, if that's true, and if there is intelligent life elsewhere, where is it? Why haven't they called to say hi? You know, why is it that we haven't had any contact? And this is what's known as Fermi's paradox. And that seems to also be a reasonable kind of question. If it's really true that there is life somewhere else, how is it that we have not, to date, seen any evidence?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And, of course, in the field and even in sort of the popular culture surrounding the question of extraterrestrial life, that it is known as Fermi's paradox. He wasn't the first person to ask that, but he encapsulated it in this wonderful way. You know, Fermi was a physicist, and he tended to simplify problems, and he just pictured the galaxy as sort of a group of particles, stars, with other particles leaping between them, and saying, you know, so you imagine if there are other intelligent species out there, and if some small fraction of them develops the ability to travel between the stars, then you can actually model how long it would take for them to come and visit all of the stars. And the answer is, it's not that long. It's maybe a few million years, maybe even 100 million years, but that's a short time in the, you know, compared to the age of the universe. So it should have happened if it can happen. So then you have the paradox, okay, so if we believe that there is other life, and if the time scale for them to travel through the galaxy is not really that long, then where are they? And there are a lot of interesting possible answers to that question. You know, that paradox of where are they has been used to argue against the existence of extraterrestrial life at all, or at least intelligent extraterrestrials, because if they did exist, they should be here. But there are a lot of good counter-arguments. And one of my favorites is just that, well, we haven't been here very long, and we haven't been looking very long. We're babies on the cosmic scene. So, you know, just the fact that, you know, for instance, we haven't heard a radio signal yet, but we've only been listening for 40 years. and that's nothing in the age of the universe. And we haven't really listened to that large a fraction of all the stars out there. So it may simply be that they're all over the place, but you know, we've been here for such a short time, and we've searched such a small, tiny fraction of the galaxy that we just haven't found them yet. There's other more interesting, well, other very interesting answers, like, for instance, there's one that scientists call the Zoo Hypothesis, which sort of sounds like a Star Trek episode, but it's been published in scientific journals, and that's basically the idea that they're there, but they don't want us to know they're there. They're protecting us from their knowledge of their existence for a variety of reasons. You know, maybe in some sense they're aware of us, but think that a species at our primitive state of development is not ready. Maybe it wouldn't be good for us, or maybe it wouldn't be good for them to make contact. If they're out there, they're probably much, much more advanced and aged and wise than we are, for the same simple reason as that on the day you're born, all the other human beings you meet are much older than you. You know, we're babies on the cosmic scene. So it's going to be up to them to decide when and how to make contact, and maybe they just don't want to. A variant of that that I discuss in my book Lonely Planets is something that I call the seedling hypothesis. Think of a forest with all the, you know, beautiful giant oak trees or giant sequoia trees, and then you have these tiny little seedlings on the forest floor. When you explore that forest, you might be enthralled by the trees and ignore the seedlings, although sometime if you came back far in the future, those seedlings might be what was of interest to you because they would have grown up. Well, maybe we're those seedlings, and in the forest, if you will, of galactic life, maybe we're just not that interesting. So maybe they just don't want to come and talk to us because there's other more interesting things for them to do.
We are talking this morning with David Grinspoon. He is principal scientist in the Department of Space Studies at the Southwest Research Institute. He is also adjunct professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at University of Colorado and has written and spoken on these issues quite a lot. He's the author of a recent book, if you'd like to read more, dealing with these issues. It's titled Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. And it's out now in the bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome. We do have somebody here to talk with us, and others are certainly invited to call. We ask people only that they're try to be brief, just so we can keep the program going and get in as many people as possible. Of course, anyone would be welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone in Belgium over near Danville to start us. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I might want to point out a thought here. Maybe it's best that there's vast differences between whatever forms of life there is. We seem to have such a easy time of destroying ourselves on this particular planet. Can you imagine what we might do between each other that might be so mutually exclusive between the two life forms that we just cannot possibly exist together?
Well, that's a very interesting thought, and to some extent it's been explored in some good science fiction. And one thing that's interesting to me is that because there are no experts in this field, by the way, even though I'm trained as a scientist and I get funded by NASA to do astrobiology and so forth, I'm not really an expert on extraterrestrial life, right? Nobody is, because we just don't know. We only have Earth life to study. So the science fiction writers have actually contributed a lot of significant ideas to this field, and I love that interplay between science and science fiction in the fertility of ideas. Now, this thought that maybe we're just so different from them that we can't interact has been explored well in fiction. I'm thinking of a couple of stories and movies. 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know, with that mysterious ending. To me, that's all about the fact that if we do encounter another species, that, you know, wondering what they're like as depicted in other maybe less imaginative science fiction where they sort of look like funny humans with forehead ridges and so forth, that kind of picture is not likely. The 2001 picture where the aliens are just so, they're inscrutable, we just can't understand them, they're mind-blowing, their motivations and their desires and their just the nature of their existence is just completely befuddling. To me, that actually seems more likely because, again, we have this probability, almost a certainty that they will be separated from us in time by a great deal. They may have been living with technology for millions of years as opposed to our hundreds of years or however you want to date it. So, yeah, I think the possibility that we would just have, you know, profound differences and find it very hard to understand each other is one to be taken seriously. Yet, to me, it's not a reason to not look and not search. I still find, you know, it's just very compelling, both on a logical and, I would say, an emotional and spiritual level, that we have to search the universe and try to learn what's out there and learn if we have any company. I just don't see how we could not do that, being the kind of curious thinking creatures that we are.
If I might ask, sir, you postulated here in the last few moments that this other group should be so much more advanced than us. What is the possibility that we can't be more advanced than them?
Well, again, it's an argument of time scales. If you think of the time scales of the universe and of our evolution in history, okay, the universe is something like 12 billion years old, you know, give or take 1 or 2 billion, we think now. Life on Earth is something like 4 billion years old, so roughly a third the age of the universe. The human race, depending on how you date it, you know, is definitely less than millions of years old, and in terms of, you know, having language and some of the more modern attributes, tool use, language, and culture, various kinds of culture, there a lot of people would date it at only 50,000 years old, our species, and then in terms of modern humans, and then in terms of being technological and having the ability to actually explore the universe and listen for signals, you know, we're talking about 40 years. So we've been at this for 40 years in a universe that's 12 billion years old. So the chances that we would meet somebody who's less experienced than we are, less advanced, is basically nil. Again, it's that argument that on the day you're born, the other people you meet are all a lot older than you, but magnify that by a million, you know. So, you know, I acknowledge there's some hidden assumptions in this argument, and I deconstruct this much more carefully in my book, Lonely Planets, because, yeah, I'm assuming, okay, there's some kind of linear progression, right, that a species that's been around a lot longer is more advanced. We could even question that assumption, although I think that we'd come around to agreeing that it's probably true if we really discussed it. So, but it's a timescale argument. You know, anybody that we meet, especially if they have the ability to travel between the stars, they're going to be much more advanced than we are. We don't have that ability. If they have the ability to broadcast a signal continuously for thousands or tens of thousands of years, which is probably what it would take for us to hear their signal, you need to be a long-term broadcaster, which we are not yet, to have a good chance of somebody else hearing you. You know, all these abilities that they are likely to have if we do indeed make contact marks them as almost surely much more aged and advanced than we are, and I think probably, therefore, wiser than we are.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go to another caller here, and I believe that we have someone on a cell phone on line number 2. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
A couple comments. I know friends of mine and I have chewed this one over a couple glasses of beer more than once. There was a couple things I think we've never really been able to, I mean, there's no answer at this point. One was how difficult interstellar travel is. It may be that interstellar travel is amazingly, amazingly, amazingly hard. And as a consequence, the argument, why aren't they here, is, well, because they can't get here, whoever they is. That'd be the first point. I have a total of three. The second one is that I think what it seems, based on the evidence we have from our world anyway, that life seems to be pretty hard to hold down, but intelligent life may be incredibly difficult. And so in different environments, you know, intelligence is expensive and it may not be that great of a selection advantage other places. So you may find that the universe is populated quite heavily with the rough equivalents of bacteria and maybe frogs, and that's about it. And a frog is pretty incredibly complicated compared to bacteria. The third one which I've never really been able, I mean, you know, who knows with any of this stuff, is we may be sort of locally the first, which is to say there may be, maybe there's advanced intelligent life on the other side of the galaxy, but how would we know? If it's, you know, if it's fairly random, or, you know, if it's a rare, a very rare event, it could be very far away from us. So I don't know if you have any comments.
Well, I do. Those are all excellent points. And, you know, I think you and your drinking buddies could have been my co-authors on this book, because I, particularly in one chapter in Lonely Planet called Fermi's Paradox, I go through some of, you know, the most likely possible answers. And I do touch on all of those. I think the first point you mentioned, that maybe interstellar travel is just so difficult that nobody ever does it or nobody has done it, that's a common argument, and it's a common argument especially made by the SETI camp. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and, you know, which is a serious group of scientists who are currently involved in the radio search for possible signals. And their point is that...
Well, let's run SETI at home, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and anybody listening who wants to get involved can run a screen server called SETI at home, which contributes to the SETI effort by helping to analyze the signals. It's this wonderful collective scientific endeavor, and you can just do a Google on SETI at home with the at being the little at symbol, and you'll find it, and you can get hooked up and become part of the grand quest. But so people that favor this idea that we're more likely to make radio contact and very unlikely to actually receive a visitor or see evidence in our solar system of visitation, one of the linchpin arguments of that is that first point you made, that they believe that interstellar travel is so unlikely because the distances are so large and the energies required are so large that no one will ever do it. I personally don't find that to be a great argument. It's possible that there is some physical barrier, some danger, some difficulty to overcome in traveling between the stars that we don't know about, and that more advanced species will know about, and that sometime in the future we'll realize, well, that's it. We have to stay at home, which would be too bad, by the way, because it would doom our species probably, because eventually, to be a very long-lived species, you have to go, you have to be an interstellar traveler, because your sun's lifetime is finite. So in 5 billion years, when our sun dies, if we haven't learned to move to another star, which I think we will have, but if we haven't, then we'll be in trouble. But to me, there's actually a narrow-minded tint to this idea that the stars are too far away. It's actually sort of, there's a hidden anthropocentric or human-centered argument, because the main argument is that it takes too long to travel to the other stars. If you go at a reasonable speed that's far below the speed of light, then it's going to take you hundreds of years at the least, maybe thousands of years, to get to another decent star. And that's too long, because we don't live that long.
Well, you can't go tell your friends.
Well, that's right. But that's if you are a current human being in the early 21st century with a lifespan of, you know, 70 to 80 years or whatever. But that we project that lifespan on all other species in the universe when we say that nobody will ever want to do that because it takes too long. I can imagine a species that has evolved with a much longer lifespan or has decided to increase their lifespan, and there are many ways you can imagine doing this.
Or, in fact, just doesn't mind, as I would point out our species did in the numerous migrations that we made during the population of our planet.
That's right. In the human diaspora of traveling around Earth, we made these voyages that took many lifetimes. And if you look at ocean voyages, even back, you know, a few hundred years ago, people would leave knowing that it was likely that they wouldn't come back. That didn't discourage them from traveling. And I think there are many ways that we could even imagine human beings traveling between the stars. You could create ships that, you know, the so-called generation ships, where the people that arrive are the distant, or not distant maybe, but are the descendants of the people that set off.
And I'd like to ask you one quickie, and then I'm going to hang up and listen. My main concern is not actually the will, because that I can, as I said, I mean, we've done it in the past. That doesn't bug me. It may bug sentimentalists, but it doesn't bug me very much on this one. What bothers me is the energy and the technology. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's some invisible barrier around stars. I just worry that the energy densities may be something that are essentially impossible to attain. And so I'm going to hang up and let you talk about that before I run out of minutes.
All right, well, thanks a lot for calling in. And my response to that is that the energies to travel between the stars, if you try to go fast, if you try to go close to the speed of light so that you could get there in a human lifetime, then the energies are absurdly large. But it's been calculated by some really smart physicists that all you have to do is slow down. And you're not, if you're not worried about the trip lasting a human lifetime, if you're willing to take 1,000 years to get to a star, then it turns out it doesn't take that much energy, or it takes much less energy. And you could probably harvest energy along the way. Interstellar space is full of hydrogen. Hydrogen is, you could use it for fusion energy, for instance. So there are actually energy sources along the way. You don't even have to bring all the fuel with you. So to my mind, saying that interstellar travel is impossible, when we do that, we're guilty of sort of projecting our own level of knowledge and our own level of advancement in technology onto that of advanced species, and we're not giving them enough credit. And, I think that whenever we say something is impossible based on our own current very young, naive experience in the universe, we're probably wrong.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. We have some other callers, so we'll get to in just a second. I do want to introduce again our guest. We're talking with David Grinspoon. He is a planetary scientist. He works in the Department of Space Studies at the Southwest Research Institute. He's also adjunct professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at University of Colorado, has done research funded by NASA, looking at the evolution of habitable worlds. He's also been an advisor to NASA on space exploration policy, has written for many different publications, is the author of the book Venus Revealed, which was an LA Times Book Prize finalist, and his most recent that explores this issue that we're here discussing is titled Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. And other questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL, or 9455. On to the next caller, and that would be in Champaign on line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting subject you're talking about right now, and I'm sure there is other life, but it's not exactly like ours. We had to have a creator, or we couldn't be here. Now, there's no way to know about this creator except that he revealed himself. And we have a Bible, which is his revelation. It tells how he made the world, how he made us, and it even has instances of life, spiritual life coming here to earth in Jesus Christ. Now, you can deny this if you want to, but one day we're going to find out that it's all true, because we're going to see clouds of angels with God coming back here to earth. And I just wish that the people would read the Bible and check it out and see that it is true and start believing it.
Wow. Well, gosh, I'm not entirely sure how to respond to that, but I will say that historically there's been a really interesting interplay between the church and advocates of extraterrestrial life. And it's interesting that you're clearly a believer in the Bible and so forth, and you started your comments by saying that you were sure there's other life out there. And what's interesting is that the Bible historically has often been used to argue just the opposite. Of course, there's the famous case of Galileo getting in trouble with the church for saying that there were other worlds and saying that the Earth is one planet among many. And the church didn't like that. They advocated the Earth being the center of everything. And then they somewhat retreated from that. They actually pardoned Galileo, by the way, in 1993, which was a little late to help Galileo, but at least it set the record straight. But then a lot of clerics in the 17th century, when people started to accept Galileo's obvious truth and accept that there were other planets, a lot of clerics used the Bible to argue against the existence of intelligent life elsewhere because of the uniqueness of the incarnation of Christ. They said, well, this world required a redeemer, and every world can't have a redeemer because Christ is unique. Therefore, there can't be intelligent life on other worlds unless you think that Christ is a planet hopper and spends all of his time going from world to world to world and helping species become intelligent, which would seem exhausting. So there have been a lot of paradoxes historically raised between literal interpretation of the Bible and between the belief in intelligent extraterrestrial life. It's interesting that the church has, of course, moved with the times and has accepted some scientifically verified truths. And I think the caller and I might differ in that I do believe that the truth will become revealed to us someday, but I don't necessarily see it as swarms of angels filling the sky, but I think that it is quite possible that some message or some being from the sky will, in fact, reveal to us the truth about our existence in the universe if we keep looking. And, you know, we could probably argue this point for a long time, but I suspect that maybe we should leave it there and move on to other topics.
Well, and again, I want to thank the caller for her comments, and we have some other people. Just real quick, I'm interested in, as people speculate about whether there is intelligent life elsewhere and what form it might take, when we look out into the universe, it seems, as far as we know, that the stuff that we can see, it's made out of the same. It's made out of the stuff that we know. With the same elements that exist here on the Earth, seem to exist elsewhere. And as far as we know, the same kind of laws of physics apply. Now, maybe we might speculate that there are beings who've found ways around them, but we don't know any right at the moment. So, when you think about the forms that life might take, you wonder, would it really be so different from the kinds of forms of life that we're familiar with?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you're absolutely right. As far as we can tell, the universe everywhere seems to be made out of the same kinds of stuff. You know, we have spectrometers, which we attach to our telescopes, which sort of break down the light and the radiation coming from distant parts of the universe and let us look at the fingerprints of what that matter is made out of. A very powerful tool was invented in the 1800s, actually, and now allows us to look at distant stars and even distant galaxies and say, well, they're made out of hydrogen and helium and some lithium, and we see carbon. Carbon, of course, being very significant because that's what we're made out of. We see water and distant stars. So all the familiar stuff that allowed life to arise here seems to exist everywhere in the universe, widely dispersed. As far as the laws of physics being the same, well, by my definition, if it's not the same everywhere, it's not the law. It's not really a law of physics. That's what a law of physics is. It's something that describes the behavior of the universe as a whole. So it may be that some things that we perceive of as universal laws of physics, it may be that we're wrong about that and that things behave differently elsewhere because what we thought was a law of physics is not. But if it's really a law of physics that's going to hold up, then almost by definition it is the same everywhere. So there is this unity of the cosmos in its physical construction. And then what we want to know, what we're trying to do with astrobiology and with SETI, is find out if that unity extends to biology. You know, are there universal principles of biology? Is life a universal occurrence in this cosmos? And for reasons we already discussed, many of us believe that it is. But, of course, we don't know. Now, as far as what forms life might take elsewhere, that's another great question. What would it look like? And there are some clues to that that I think we have from some surprising places. But this might be a reasonable time to mention, by the way, that if people want a visual component to this radio listening experience, there is a website related to the book Lonely Planets, and it's just simply lonelyplanets.net, lonelyplanets.net. And the reason I mention it now is that there's a picture, there's a lot of images on that site that relate to questions of extraterrestrial life. And if you go to the images section of lonelyplanets.net, there's one picture that, to me, speaks to this question of what aliens might look like. And it's actually a mathematical equation something called a fractal that you've probably heard about from complexity theory. And what's remarkable about these fractals is that even though they're just these abstract mathematical equations, many of them perfectly describe the shapes of life on Earth, which to me is quite profound, because these equations were not invented by human beings, in my view. They were discovered by human beings. So there's something universal about math that transcends our consciousness. And when we meet the aliens, I think they'll have discovered the same kinds of math, which would be really, it would be very cool to compare our math books with theirs and see if some of the illustrations look the same. I think they will. But the fact that some of these fractal equations from complexity theory describe so perfectly the shapes of some life on Earth, and yet these equations aren't from Earth, they're from the cosmos, tell me that some of these biological shapes that we have on Earth are indeed probably universal, and there probably are, for instance, creatures shaped like ferns, and the familiar spirals of a nautilus tail, and the familiar symmetry of a skeletal structure. I think some of these overall geometrical principles of life we will find are, in fact, universal responses to the laws of physics in the universe. And so when we meet the aliens, they will look strange to us, because evolution is random and takes strange turns and can't be predicted, yet they won't look entirely unfamiliar to us. I think some of the geometrical elements we see in creatures from other planets will indeed look like the geometrical elements of life on Earth, because of these hints of a universal architecture of life that we see coming from complexity theory. And again, if you do look at lonelyplanets.net, I direct you to the image that's called Life is Math. And it looks like a fern, and it shows you the equation, and then also the image after that one in the sequence. And maybe you'll get more of an idea of what the heck I'm talking about.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers here, and let's talk with some more of them. The next person in line is in Champaign, and line number two. Hello.
Three. Hello.
Yes.
Hi there. Let's see. I had a couple of questions. One, I'm afraid, might be related to the previous callers. I'd heard that there are some people, like Frank Tipler, I think that's the name, who had been claiming what they called scientific arguments to say that life is likely unique. I haven't read his book or any of the others. Do you? Can you say anything about his arguments and whether you believe them? That's one. And the other question was, so how long has it been thought that that life is, by a lot of scientific community, that life is very likely widespread? I think the first I'd heard about it was in Carl Sagan's Cosmos series about 20 years ago. But anyway, so those are my questions.
Yeah, both good questions. First of all, Frank Tipler's argument that you're referring to isn't exactly that life is unique. If I understand, I think you're referring to what's known as the anthropic principle. And it's a very controversial idea of cosmology that basically states that in a certain sense, the universe was made the way it is so that we could end up being here. It sounds almost creationist, which is why perhaps you imply that it's related to the previous caller. But it's not really creationism, because it actually depends on some subtle principles of cosmology. It looks at the ways that our universe seems tuned to allow the development of life and intelligent life. In other words, if you varied this physical law a little bit, then carbon atoms wouldn't be stable and we couldn't be here. If you varied the strength of gravity a little bit, then stars would not be stable and we couldn't be here. So there's this idea that the kind of complexity, the kind of stability that matter has found, that has allowed life, has allowed us to be here, requires some very fine-tuning of the laws of physics. It's an interesting argument. I don't buy it. And I don't buy it because I think that there's a flaw in the logic, which basically is that my counter-argument is that, yes, if you change some of these laws of physics, the kind of complexity, the specific kind of complexity that allows our kind of star and our kind of carbon chemistry and allowed the evolution of us would not be here in a different universe. But what we don't know is, if you change those laws of physics, what other kinds of complexity would arise, would be allowed. And I think that we don't have the science yet that can predict that, that can know the answer to that. So I think all you can say is that we wouldn't be here if you changed the laws of the universe, but somebody else might be, and we don't know who would be, and we don't know if we would be actually improving the universe for life. We shouldn't assume that the universe is necessarily optimized for life just because we're here.
So he is not even claiming that. So there might be lots of intelligent life forms in the universe as it is now.
As far as I understand it, but you might be confusing this, or you might not be. But there's another recent idea that's known as the rare earth hypothesis.
Oh, I guess I would thought he was advocating that.
Yeah, that's not Tipler. That's Ward and Brownlee at the University of Washington. Another interesting idea that I think is basically also logically flawed, and that's not an argument about the universe as a whole so much as an argument about the Earth. In the rare earth hypothesis, they look at all the details of Earth history, the unlikely path that allowed human beings to arise. And you know, Earth history is quite convoluted and has some sort of accidental random features that you wouldn't find on other planets. One of the most striking is the formation of our moon in a large impact with a Mars-sized planet early in Earth's history that altered a lot of the physical parameters of our planet. And then, you know, you need a planet the right size, the right distance from a star so you can have liquid water, all these things. And they say you add up all these things and you say, what are the chances that you would get another planet with all these accidents of history? And they're basically nil. And so they say, we're alone. There is no other complex life. To me, again, this argument is flawed because it assumes that Earth is optimized for life. And I think they're right in saying that nowhere else in the cosmos are you going to find another planet just like Earth with our unusual history. Just as you're never going to find another human being that's exactly like you. You'll find somebody with the same characteristics, but humans are complex. They have, we have genetics, we have history, we're all individuals. And I think planets are going to be the same way once we explore the universe, and we've already got hints of that, that planets are individuals. So I think Rare Earth is right in saying there's not going to be another planet just like Earth, but they're logically flawed when they say, because of that, there is not going to be other complex life in our galaxy. Because we don't know, again, if Earth is optimized for the evolution of complex life. It's a very, I think, Earth-centered argument. It may be that if you had a planet sort of like Earth, but with some different physical parameters, that it would be a much better place to make life, and that intelligent life would have arisen after just a billion years rather than after 4 billion years. So, you know, we don't know enough about planets and about life to make this kind of argument that our planet is the best of all possible worlds and that other planets are going to be less suited for life. We have to do a lot more exploring before we can make any kind of draconian claim like that. And my hunch is that what we're going to find is that there are many different kinds of planetary environments that can support life and even intelligent life. And some of them will be like Earth in some ways, and some of them will be quite unlike Earth. If I can get to your other question briefly, which is how long has this idea that life is widespread been around? And does it just go back to cosmos in the 70s? The answer is absolutely no. It's been around much, much longer than that. If you read literature from the 1600s, immediately after the Copernican Revolution, you'll find that there was rampant belief in widespread intelligent life all over the universe. In fact, even more widespread than most of the 20th century. Because you see, right after we discovered that the other planets were worlds and that Earth was a world, like among many, we knew nothing about the other planets at that point other than that they were worlds. Absolutely nothing. We had no information, but we knew they were other planets. So the simplest assumption was that they really were just like Earth. And people even imagined human beings, you know, driving horses and carriages around or whatever. We always project the ideas of our day onto life elsewhere. And I think in some subtle ways, even now, with all our modern science and modern ideas, we're still doing that. We imagine that extraterrestrial life is carbon-based, and we imagine that they use radio telescopes to communicate. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but we can't help projecting ourselves out into the cosmos because we don't know who's out there. And this idea that there is widespread intelligent life goes back, way before the 1970s. It goes back at least to the 1600s, and I think you can even argue really that it's much older than that.
We're at a point, unfortunately, where we're just about going to have to stop. My apologies. We have some callers we can't take. There are people who make the argument that it is very probable that within our solar system, there are places where conditions would be suitable for some kind of life, assuming that we can deal with the technical challenges involved in looking, which are not small, do you think that it is possible that we will indeed, within the relative near future, discover that there are living things in our very solar system?
Yeah, it's quite possible. And you mentioned the technical challenges, and of course this week I'm wincing when you say that phrase. We, you know, exploring the other planets is not easy.
Yep.
It is rocket science, as they say, and you know, we are going to have failures, and we're going to keep going, and we're going to have successes. But yeah, you know, we're exploring Mars quite intensively now, and some people think that Mars is a good place to look for life. In my opinion, Mars is a great place to look for fossils of past life, and a very unlikely place to find present life because it's kind of died out geologically. And an idea that I explore in Lonely Planets, I don't really have time to get into now, but it's called the Living Worlds Hypothesis, and I propose that a planet needs to be geologically active in order to be biologically alive.
Mm-hmm.
So Mars is not my favorite place to look for life in the solar system, although I'm very much in favor of exploring Mars because we can learn a lot about the history of life by going there. But there are other places in our solar system that are quite promising. One great place, I think, that we need to go to look for life is a moon of Jupiter called Europa, which, as we understand it now, has a vast ocean of liquid water beneath its icy surface. And as far as we know about life, which admittedly is not very far yet, and that's why we need to keep exploring, but as far as we know, life needs water. And where there's water, there's life. That's what we find on Earth, at least. And Europa, it turns out, has our solar system's largest ocean of liquid water. It's not on the Earth, it's on Europa. So we have to go there and look for life. If what we understand about the basic requirements for life is, in fact, accurate, then Europa should have life. So we could go there and we can test our notions about life elsewhere.
We're going to have to stop, and I just again would want to say for people who are interested in reading on the subject, look for the book we've talked about. It's titled Lonely Planets, and it's published by HarperCollins by our guest, David Grinspoon. David, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks. I've enjoyed it.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, a show that was first broadcast on December 31st of last year. Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields' catering department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. That's it for us. I want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, two tax experts will be with me in the studio to answer our questions about filing the tax return for 2003. Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein of the Tax Department of RSM McGladrey Incorporated will join us following the 1 o'clock news. On the Chicago Board of Trade,